Good evening, I'm Ted O'Brien, and this is Boston University's World of Ideas. Ah, spring, when a young man's fancy lightly turns to baseball, and then when he's a little older, to love.
You ask how much I need you, must I explain? I need you, oh my darling, like roses need rain. You ask how long I'll love you, I'll tell you true, until the 12th of never. Still be loving you. Hold me close. Never let me go. Hold me close. Melt my heart like April snow. I'll love you till the bluebells forget to bloom. I'll love you till the clover has lost its perfume. I'll love you till
tonight, we'll trace the origins of romantic love, how it became an important part of Western society, and what role it plays in our lives today. From time to time, we'll read from some of the works that most perfectly express the emotion. And to do that, we welcome Boston Globe writer, columnist, and occasional poet, Bella English. Bella?
Hi, Ted.
Medieval historian and director of the Center of Millennial Studies, Professor Richard Landis.
Hi, Ted.
And professor of English Robert Levine of the College of Arts and Sciences, who is an expert on the troubadours, whose repertoire includes some of the earliest love songs in Western civilization.
Hi, Ted.
Great to have you all with us. And let's begin with the question that people have been asking probably for eons, but we'll ask it tonight. What is romantic love?
Well, Ann Landers would say it's one set of glands calling to another, and that's true when you're a teenager. Romantic love, well, it's a mixture of chemistry, hope, intimacy, commitment. What else? Help me out here, guys.
Well, I'd certainly pick up on the notion of intimacy. I think that one of the basic elements of romantic love and part of the rush that gets the hormones going is the sense that you are in the presence of somebody with which you can share your entire being. So there's a sort of meeting of souls at a particularly profound level.
Is this infatuation, Bob Levine?
Well, I'll be safest by quoting a 12th century Latin writer, Andreas Capellanus, to give you his definition. Love is a certain inborn suffering derived from the sight of and excessive meditation upon the beauty of the opposite sex, which causes each one to wish above all things the embraces of the other, and by common desire to carry out all of love's precepts in the other's embrace.
Inborn suffering?
It sounds like someone's lovesick here.
Yeah, I mean, I think part of what's going on there, to distinguish from infatuation, obviously hormones play a big role, and the appearance of the other person plays a big role. And so there's a tendency when you find somebody that physically appeals to you to project onto them all of the kinds of things you hope to find in the person that you love, and that helps the infatuation play out. I would say that genuine love, and I don't even know if I'd call it romantic love, but genuine love is when you can peel away the projections and you're actually meeting somebody else rather than just sort of imagining something. I think a lot of the courtly love tradition is a sort of magnification of projection to an extraordinary degree, and great poetry comes of it.
I lost concrete of us
This is the beginning of the second verse of one of the best-known troubadour works. It's by Bernard de Ventadorn. Through seven verses, de Ventadorn bemoans the fact that his lady won't return his advances. What he's saying here is this: alas, how much of love I thought I knew, and how little I know. For I cannot stop loving her from whom I may have nothing. All my heart and all herself, and all my own self, and all I have, she has taken from me, and leaves me nothing but longing and a seeking heart. After continuing for five more verses in a similar vein, de Ventadorn ends with this: you will not see my sorrow, since I am going wretched, not knowing where. I renounce and deny my song, and flee from joy and from love. Where did we get the idea of romantic love? Did we always have these notions? And were these troubadours, how'd they get involved in this courtly love thing?
Well, they composed songs like the modern ones. For instance, one of the great modern love songs is the Ten Commandments of Love. Now, that is a kind of parody of the feeling that there are Ten Commandments. And again, Andreas gives us many commandments of love.
Were these commandments realized outside the court?
Or? Well, I would say that these commandments are, again, comments on the nature of people's statements about love. Andreas, for instance, tells us in Rule 15, every lover regularly turns pale in the presence of his beloved. Rule 16, when a lover suddenly catches sight of his beloved, his heart palpitates. So the modern songs that go along with that, like It's a Heartache, Only a Heartache.
Make My Heart Beat Faster.
Right. He's having a good time with the commonplaces of a lyric tradition. It's purely literary.
Well, bless my soul, but what's wrong with me? I'm itching like a man on a fuzzy tree. My friends say I'm acting wild as a bug. I'm in love. I'm all shook up. Ooh, ooh, yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, my hand is shaky and my knees are weak. I can't seem to stand on my own two feet. Who do you think of when you have such luck? I'm in love. I'm all shook up. Ooh, ooh, yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, please. Ask me what's on my mind. I'm a little mixed up, but I feel fine when I'm near the girl that I love best. My heart beats so it scares me to death when she touches my hand. What a chill I got. Her lips are like a volcano that's hot. I'm proud to say that she's my buttercup. I'm in love. I'm all shook up. Ooh, ooh. My tongue gets tied when I try to speak. My insides shake like a leaf on a tree. There's only one cure for this body of mine. That's to have that girl and her love so fine. She touched my head and what a chill I got. Her lips are like a volcano that's hot. I'm proud to say that she's my buttercup. I'm in love. I'm all shook up. Ooh, ooh, yeah.
Well, this tradition, which is related to being in love with a woman who has forbidden you, largely because of a combination of her being already married to somebody else and on top of it being of a higher social class, part of this is that they're describing a love that is cannot be consummated. Doesn't mean that it isn't. Maybe I should say may not be consummated. So this idea of, you know, your heart leaps, you know, this is typical crush stuff in high school. You go into the class with the girl that you never talk to, but then she walks in and, you know, your heart leaps. But that, I think that there's a larger issue here. And we actually have a series of charters from the 11th century that introduce really new stuff. These are donations to church property by people, and they start in the 11th century. They begin to quote Adam and Eve as a model for the relationship, and it's the man and the woman both giving property to the church. So this idea of Adam and Eve as a model for two individuals who, in a sense, are equal in their relationship, we can trace back to the 11th century. And to come back, actually, to the question of intimacy, I think that this notion of equality, this notion that when you're in love with somebody else, there is no hierarchy, that there's an intimacy that emerges from dropping the hierarchy, may in fact be one of the characteristics that makes it so strong in the Western tradition.
Thanks, Richard Landis. Bella English, let me ask you, is romantic love the same for men and women? Or do women experience it differently?
The old cliche is that women experience it more emotionally and more maybe intellectually, and that men experience more physically and viscerally.
Okay.
Well, I think that's the standard reading, and probably with the extensive mixing up of gender roles that's occurred in the latest period of our culture, it's probably less true than it was. But certainly at the infatuation stage, I'd argue that.
Well, Andreas, once again. Since Andreas in the last book wants to convince people to have no interest in women.
Mind you, Andreas never could have gotten married.
Well, he was a cleric, right?
Yeah. Well, and if they, after such, this routine, he certainly never would have.
Yeah. He was sworn to celibacy.
Well,
no.
Yeah, okay.
So what does he know?
She was sworn to institutional celibacy, right.
Well, here's what he says. Every woman in the world is likewise wanton, because no woman, no matter how famous and honored she is, will refuse her embraces to any man, even the most vile and abject, if she knows that he is good at the work of Venus. Yet there is no man so good at the work that he can satisfy the desires of any woman you please in any way at all. So that's one medieval idea.
I agree with the second part of that.
Well. Christopher Marlowe, the passionate shepherd to his love. Come live with me and be my love, and we will all the pleasures prove that valleys, groves, hills, and fields, woods, or sleepy mountains yield. And we will sit upon the rocks, seeing the shepherds feed their flocks by shallow rivers, to whose falls melodious birds sing madrigals. And I will make thee beds of roses, and 1,000 fragrant posies, a cap of flowers, and a kirtle embroidered all with leaves of myrtle, a gown made of the finest wool, which from our pretty lambs we pull, fair lined slippers for the cold, with buckles of the purest gold, a belt of straw and ivy buds, with coral clasps and amber studs, and if these pleasures may thee move, come live with me and be my love. The shepherd swains shall dance and sing for thy delight each May morning. If these delights thy mind may move, then live with me and be my love.
The nymphs reply to the shepherd of Sir Walter Raleigh. If all the world and love were young, and truth in every shepherd's tongue, these pretty pleasures might me move to live with thee and be thy love. Time drives the flocks from field to fold when rivers rage and rocks grow cold, and Philomel becometh dumb, the rest complain of cares to come. The flowers do fade in wanton fields to wayward winter reckoning yields. A honey tongue, a heart of gall, is fancy spring, but sorrow's fall. Thy gowns, thy shoes, thy beds are roses, thy cap, thy kirtle, and thy posies soon break, soon wither, soon forgotten, and folly ripe and reason rotten. Thy belt of straw and ivy buds, thy coral clasps and amber studs, all these in me no means can move to come to thee and be thy love. But could youth last and love still breed, had joys no date nor age no need, then these delights my mind might move to live with thee and be thy love.
Is this romantic love only a before marriage or an outside of marriage thing? As it is
or
in literature?
Or an early marriage thing, maybe?
I guess the crucial question is here the adjective romantic. Because in principle, a good marriage is something where the couple is in love, maybe on and off, but steadily throughout the marriage. Romantic, I think, has this... How do we distinguish romantic and infatuative?
Well, I think that's a good question. I think a lot of us confuse romantic with sexual love.
All right.
The eros part of the relationship. And I would say the shelf life of that is probably pretty short. And then reality sets in. And that is, you know, the dirty socks left on the bathroom floor, the toothpaste cap left off, the dirty diapers that need to be changed at 2 in the morning.
But again, this is the last quote I'll get from Andreas, because he has something to say on each of these topics. He has a series of conversations between a man and a woman. The man is generally trying to seduce the woman. Mm-hmm. And here is the way one of the men argues with the woman. I am greatly surprised, this woman is married, that you wish to misapply the term love to that marital affection which husband and wife are expected to feel for each other after marriage, since everybody knows that love can have no place between husband and wife. Hmm. They may be bound to each other by a great and immoderate affection, but their feeling cannot take the place of love because it cannot fit under the true definition of love. For what is love but an inordinate desire to receive passionately a furtive and hidden embrace? But what embrace between husband and wife can be furtive? And he goes on.
So it's the forbidden fruit argument.
Absolutely.
It's the forbidden fruit. It's the grass is always greener syndrome.
Right.
Was that love ever actually realized? For example, what if unarranged a knight has fallen in love with some lord's daughter? Could he actually try to marry her or
sure.
Was it all over?
No, sure he could. I mean, there are lots of cases where you have that kind of thing going on. The question is, once they get married, were they able to stick it together without a marriage counselor to help them? And to some extent, somebody slightly more wise than Andreas Kapalanis as their as their spiritual advisor might have been able to help them through it. Well, you know, you've got the case, a fabulous case of Eleanor of Aquitaine, who's married to this dud, Louis VII, and she meets Henry II and falls madly in love with him. They have this incredibly tempestuous relationship for the rest of their lives. But that's a case of, you know, sort of tremendous love that leads to marriage, completely changes the political configuration of Europe because all of Aquitaine goes from France to England, is the source of wars for who knows how long, and it's driven by this passion. And, of course, Eleanor is famous for holding one of the most significant Andreas's writing for Eleanor's court.
When somebody loves you, it's no good unless he loves you. All the way, happy to be near you when you need someone to cheer you. All the way, taller than the tallest tree is, that's how it's got to feel. Deeper than the deep blue sea is, that's how deep it goes if it's real. When somebody needs you, it's no good unless she needs you. All the way through the good or lean years and for all those in between years, come what may. Who knows where the road will lead us?
What about the rest of society outside the courts? Okay. Were marriages arranged then in these times? And were there no love matches?
One of the interesting things, again, to get back to the 11th, 12th century, is that, in fact, it's in this period where you, in fact, do not need a priest to marry you. But the priest who does marry you is under the obligation to make sure that this is a voluntary marriage. And I think that the whole notion of a marriage being something that's undertaken voluntarily is moving towards a notion of romantic love, at least as in one way of defining it, which is that this is something that's occurring not merely because of a set of social constraints, but in fact because of a desire on both parts.
Well, maybe not desire on both parts all the time. I think marriage was considered much more of a status thing for women than for men. They wanted to get the knight or the courtier or the king or whomever. And they had to, the family had to give away dowry and things, and that had to be arranged. And they didn't have any choice a lot of times. The women didn't. That's the other side of it.
No, absolutely.
But the men did have a choice.
There are all sorts of pressures that can be put on. Just the very fact that this is a principle suggests that there are some cases where this is a matter, where people do have a right of refusal. I mean, the higher up on the food chain you are, the less freedom you have in choosing. Mm-hmm. And I think that comes out in the fairy tales and stuff that, you know, the peasants have, you know, access to something that the aristocracy doesn't. The aristocracy is in their gilded cages.
So the peasants were happier than the rest of
them? Not necessarily. Obviously, the parents weren't happy, but they had access to something that the aristocracy didn't.
What I hear you saying, Richard Landis, is that romantic love always existed among the peasantry.
Well, I wouldn't say the peasantry. Let's call them the commoners.
We need another angle on this, so I have to go back to Andreas. We say that it rarely happens we find farmers serving in love's court, but naturally, like a horse or a mule, they give themselves up to the work of Venus as nature's urgings teaches them to do. For a farmer, hard labor and the uninterrupted solaces of plow and mattock are sufficient. Then, Andreas says, what do you do if you fall in love with
a peasant
girl? And his advice is, rape her.
Oh, my.
Yeah, no, wait. I mean, all right. So, you know, Andreas is really a skewed source. You know, we have two different kinds of pastorals, which are these discussions between a knight and a peasant girl. And in one, the peasant girl is the dumb blonde, and the knight gets his way by tricking her. And the other, which tend to be the southern ones, the peasant girl is actually smarter than the knight, sees through his tricks, and teaches him a lesson in courtly love by calling him on what he's all about and says, I'm going to save myself for somebody else.
When did it become more than a literary conceit? One reading of that time indicated that the Black Plague, which wiped out a third of Europe, made labor conversely more valuable because of the scarcity and gave the underpinnings for the rise of the individual, which would also play into this idea. If people had become more valuable then as individuals, was individuation beginning to take place then? And
well, certainly if you hear, 1381, which is 30 years after the Black Plague and in direct response to the kinds of forces you're talking about, you have peasants saying when Adam delved and Eve span, who was then the gentle man, that's an argument that we're all individuals and we're all equal. And it's the use of a kind of biblical verse. Now, there's nothing particularly romantic about it, but in terms of the sort of dignity of the individual, whatever his social class, I think you definitely have this current in Western history possibly stronger than almost any other culture I can think of.
What about changes that made it possible for women or more women to support themselves? Were those happening? When did those begin to happen? They could own property in that age.
Sure,
correct?
But I mean, so could Roman matrons.
I see.
It was after their husbands died.
Did that give them any power, or were they all, you know, subject to the other male members of the family?
I think that's a fairly recent phenomenon.
Well,
I think
it goes
beyond.
I would argue that marital rights are still in transition. Mm-hmm. And, in fact, I'm writing this, working on a story about a child custody dispute in which there's a big issue about equality between, you know, child custody and which parent and women's rights. And, you know, I remember my mother back in the 50s was not allowed to buy a piece of property that she wanted to buy in Florida without my father signing it. And he refused to sign it. Hmm. So she didn't get to buy the property.
Oh,
that long ago.
One of the most successful elements of the attempted cultural revolution of the 60s was, in fact, feminism and women's liberation. And that really has sort of thrown all sorts of question marks into the relationship between men and women. And on one level, it's been a lot easier in the past to have the relationships between men and women relatively clear because of this idea of, you know, the man is the dominant one, the one who pursues, the woman is the submissive one, or the one who refuses, and so on. And now when you mix it up, it raises just a huge range of problems that I think are extremely interesting. I'm not arguing for going back, but it certainly raises a whole bunch of issues.
I think it's a sign of the times, and Gloria Steinem, you know, the foremost feminist
right.
in the country, finally, at age 66, decides to get married because it's safe to be married now. She said she worked for a generation trying to change the institution of marriage.
Uh-huh.
And she was the one who made the great comment back in the 60s. People asked her why she didn't have kids. She said, "I can't mate in captivity." And so she is not only married for the first time at age 66, she has married a younger man. And more power to her. And I asked her about it. She said, "Well, you know, the rules have changed."
Obviously, romantic love then becomes a matter of choice. That is, I don't think romantic love can exist without choice.
Right.
And therefore, freedom.
And
yes.
You choose the only person on earth that you think there is for you. I think Goethe said, you know that you're really in love when you think no one else has ever been in love, has loved before you have
uh-huh.
loved.
Uh-huh.
Which to me is a bit of nonsense, because that to me is more like infatuation.
Well, actually, it's interesting, because I think that one of the qualities that he's getting at there is this idea that when you have this experience of genuine intimacy, since you've never experienced it before, it's almost as if you never imagined it existed, and therefore you never imagined that anybody else experienced it. So there's this sense of sort of discovering yourself almost on a kind of cosmic level that you didn't know existed before.
Well, that sounds more like the thunderbolt, which, you know, from Michael
comes
Corleone.
From above, not that, from within.
Yeah, that strikes you and changes everything, which is more infatuation, isn't it, than romantic love?
Not necessarily.
Depends on how long it lasts.
Yeah.
Okay.
Not necessarily. I mean, you know, I think that just because it's powerful doesn't mean that it's short-lived.
My heart heals. Right.
Is it a peculiarly Western phenomenon in a mass way in terms of the larger society? Bob Levine, do you want to deal with that?
The little I've read outside of Western literature would seem to say no, it's not particularly Western. What's that song by Bruce thing? Yes, everybody has a hungry heart. Yes, mm-hmm. no matter.
Do you disagree with that, though?
Yeah, I disagree in the sense that I think that romantic love, or however we want to define it, this sense of, you know, a kind of overriding passion that will, you know, there are no barriers to it, is probably true in every culture. I think that I don't know of any other culture where the social paradigm that we exist under now, which says that we should be able to, and we should marry the people we love, that arranged marriage is not the standard form of marriage, is extremely unusual. It's a very disruptive system. I mean, you can't really have it in a culture where classes are clearly defined, where marriage is primarily a financial transaction or a social transaction, and so on. So the idea that you can have a culture that would say the standard is people should marry the people they fall in love with, I think, is a very unusual cultural trait, and I would say yes, as a sort of social paradigm or mass phenomenon, it's pretty unique to Western culture.
Bella English?
Well, I'm just thinking of cases that have been the news in the last few years, and that is in the Middle East, you always have some sort of a king or aristocrat banishing his daughter who was made the mistake of falling in love with somebody.
With
the wrong person. Or even the emperor of Japan married the girl. That was an arranged marriage. She went to Belmont High School in Harvard. And that was an arranged marriage. That was only about one of the last 10 years.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And those are all Eastern cultures. So I would have to say I do think that at least those, they may be changing, but I think that we have definitely led the way.
I think we underestimate, because we almost take it for granted, just how disruptive the very notion of romantic love and individual choice in mates is. And most cultures can't tolerate that level of disorder at such a crucial nexus of social order, which is marriage, you know, sort of one of the foundation stones. And one of the arguments that people on the, say, the moral right make is precisely that this kind of freedom has led to all kinds of divorce, which leads to sort of children who grow up in broken homes and an increase in sort of sociopathological behavior and so on. And, you know, this is not something you can ignore, because, in fact, in the history of mankind, social order, however onerous the price has been, has come precisely from these kinds of constraints.
But two steps forward, one step back. Mm-hmm. The concept of romantic love obviously means some kind of equality that maybe didn't exist before. Because where women were chattels, there wasn't any question.
It's also there's this phenomenon, very notable in the Arab world, but true in many other places as well, of honor killings, where a daughter in some way transgresses, even by being raped, transgresses the family honor and is eliminated by the family for having done this. So, there's no question that marriage is a key element in part of a sort of social effort to maintain order by maintaining hierarchy, having men superior to women. And romantic love is an enormously subversive notion that cuts at all of these kinds of hierarchical principles.
That's Richard Landis. He's a medieval historian and director of the Center for Millennial Studies. I'm Ted O'Brien, and with us also Bella English from the Boston Globe, a writer, a columnist, and an occasional poet, and Bob Levine from the College of Arts and Sciences, whose expertise is in English.
It's sort of an irony that a romantic love and choice in your life's mate, it seems to me, would be more of a stabilizing force and more of a, so it would solidify, it behooves society to believe in choice and romantic love and instead of these sort of arranged marriages. I mean, I'm just thinking about the Moonies, you know.
Yes, mass weddings.
These mass weddings in Madison Square Garden of 20,000 people, and they are strangers to each other.
Right.
And, you know, the Reverend Moon picks out a girl and says, okay, you're going to be married to this gentleman sitting over here across the room. And I actually attended a press conference with three of these couples they put up there after they were engaged. They're engaged one day and they're going to be married in identical wedding gowns at the garden the next day. And so they paraded three couples out. And so they did their dog and pony show. And then I said, well, let me just ask you a question. Are you, to the girl, I said, are you in love with him? And you, to the man, are you in love with her? You're going to be married tomorrow. They said, we love everybody.
Mm. Oh, boy.
Very sort of moony tone of voice.
Oh.
So I guess he thinks that these arranged marriages are going to produce offspring and they're all going to be little moonies, and that's going to increase his church.
Yeah, there's actually a famous Roman tale of an empress who decided that she would marry off her slaves. Somebody made a remark that only God marries people, and so she decided she would marry off her slaves. And within a year, half of them were dead.
They killed each other
because you can't.
Well, all right. Before we leave this topic, is romantic love making inroads into other cultures?
I would think yes. And I think that one of the things that many cultures are afraid of in terms of the United States and Europe and westernization is precisely the loss of control over women that it represents. To get back to something that Bella said in this context, you know, you would think that voluntary marriage would actually be a stabilizing force in society. And I think in principle, that is how it should work. But then it gets back to Bella's earlier question about, you know, how do you stabilize this romantic passion into something that lasts for a whole lifetime? And the point is that in some senses, it's easier to maintain a stable marriage where there aren't these outlandish expectations and equally outlandish disappointments. And our job, in fact, is essentially to find the kind of maturity that permits us to, let's say, use the booster rocket of romantic love to make it into a stable orbit.
Yeah, it's called kids and grandkids, grandchildren.
Where do kids fit into this notion of romantic love? They're the fruit of romantic love, ideally.
Yeah, they are.
And then they sustain it, or how does that work?
I think they are the bonds that hold a marriage together long term. I will see my two kids holding hands and walking, my husband holding one hand on one side and one holding the other. I look across there, I think they literally are the bond between me and my husband. Mm-hmm. I think when marriages might get into trouble is when those kids go off to college. And
or when
sudden,
they become abominable teenagers.
Or when they become teenagers, exactly.
But, yeah, I think that in a sense kids represent the next stage in which the kind of intimacy and the kind of challenges that your mate posed to you at an earlier stage now become the kind of challenges that are posed to you both in terms of how do you raise children, how do you communicate values to children. You know, the biggest challenge in the world. And the most rewarding challenge is to raise kids who are, you know, good people.
So is romantic love only for the young, or is it possible to be romantically involved at any age?
Oh, I don't think so.
Any age. It's a question of taking risks and being vulnerable.
They say that falling in love is wonderful. So wonderful. So they say. The thing that's known as romance is wonderful, so wonderful, so they tell me.
Now, the passion, that's a different question.
Yeah, so how do sex and romantic love go together? Or when did they come together? And why?
Do you want details? You know, I think it's really hard to define. I think you're trying to define chemistry. And I think it's like Potter Stewart said about pornography, I know it when I see it. Mm. I think it is just indefinable. I think it comes from deep within. It comes from hormones and chemical reactions in your body. I don't know how you describe it. To me, it's totally irrational. And it defies reason. And that's what makes it so mysterious. That's what gives its mystery and its power, I think. It's almost like a power over you. You are powerless to stop this beating heart and this.
I second the emotion.
A fine madness, the poet with his rolling in a fine frenzy. Is it healthy or does it raise false expectations?
Depends on what we're talking about. If it's infatuation, then it can be very unhealthy, and the false expectations can be very embittering when they're disappointed. I think that, you know, if we talk about romantic love as intimacy, then sexuality becomes one of the highest acts of that intimacy. On the other hand, sexuality can actually be precisely the opposite of intimacy.
I think one of the key ingredients is selflessness and commitment and maturity. This sounds like buzzwords I use to my 14-year-old daughter. You know? You know, you have to be in a committed relationship. You have to be mature. You have to be responsible. It has to be reciprocal. And mutual. Mm. Otherwise, I think then you are back to this sort of fatal attraction, Looney Tunes, off the deep end sort of behavior that it can be very self-destructive. I think love brings out the best in you, not the worst in you, hopefully.
Boy, I'll tell you, it's almost, it has to like be there, as you said, before you can understand it.
Well, another interesting question is the mutuality. Do you have to have two people to have romantic love? Do you have to have two people to have passion?
Well, I think maybe you've got
the
difference.
Because otherwise what you're dealing with is projections. In other words, if you believe that the other person is madly in love with you and in fact they're not, then it's entirely been an act of projecting. They're your Rorschach test.
Right.
And you're headed for some really serious disappointments.
I guess I disagree. I think the fun part of loving is I love somebody. I don't know whether they love me or not. I can't feel what they're feeling. I can only feel what I feel. It's wonderful. So I would like to go around just in love with everybody. Just like those.
Yeah, like those Moonies.
Like the Moonies.
You know I can be found. Sit home all alone. If you can't come around, at least please tell the phone. Don't be cruel. Who heart is true. Baby, if I made you mad for something I might have said, please don't forget my past. The future looks bright ahead. Don't be cruel to who heart is true. I don't want no other love. Baby, it's just you I'm thinking of. Don't stop thinking of me. Don't make me feel this way.
How do you go about recovering from a disappointing romantic experience?
You don't.
Chocolate.
Chocolate wine. I think time and distance.
Well, time and distance and, you know, part of being alive is making mistakes, and it's only with experience that we grow wise, and we grow wise when we learn. So I would say that not only time and distance and so on, but also processing, you know, to learn what it was that in the last relationship didn't work, what were the mistakes that you made and so on, goes a long way not only towards giving you a better understanding of yourself, but increasing the odds that the next time you're not going to make the same mistake.
No, it's hopeless. Nothing you learn in one situation has anything to do with the next.
Does the answer lie in the past? I mean, we've quoted from some literary works from a cynic who reminded me of the person that said, if he doesn't play the game, he can't make the rules.
Right.
Exactly.
Somebody lost their job over that trick.
Or some of the others, some of the poets who, as Shakespeare did in this piece, seem to step up and try to do something timeless. This is obviously from the sonnets. Let me not to the marriage of true minds admit impediments. Love is not love which alters when it alteration finds, or bends with the remover to remove. Oh, no. It is an ever-fixed mark that looks on tempests and is never shaken. It is the star to every wandering bark whose worth's unknown, although his height be taken. Love's not time's fool, though rosy lips and cheeks within his bending sickle's compass come. Love alters not with his brief hours and weeks, but bears it out even to the edge of doom. If this be error, and upon me proved, I never writ, nor no man ever loved.
Well, we said that at my wedding. I'm still married 22 years ago, so he knew what he was talking about.
Who chose it?
I did. Of course.
A romantic.
Well, I am, I have to say. But I hate to make a generalization, but I do think, despite all the things you've been reading that have been by men, I do think that women tend to be more romantic at heart.
Most of the romantic love poetry that we are familiar with is by men who praise women or who praise being in love with women. How much of a tradition is there for the other way around? Are there women praising men in literature?
Emily Dickinson's love poems are wonderful. Of course, we never really found out who she was in love with. That's still, and since she never left her house, hardly.
Did you bring one with you?
Well, I brought a few.
All right, let's hear her.
This goes back to a little bit about the sort of insanity of passionate love. The Lovers, it's called. The rose did caper on her cheek, her bodice rose and fell. Her pretty speech, like drunken men, did stagger pitiful. Her fingers fumbled at her work, her needle would not go. What ails her smart little maid, it puzzled me to know. Till opposite I spied a cheek that bore another rose, just opposite another speech that, like the drunkard, goes. A vest that, like the bodice, danced to the immortal tune. So those two troubled little clocks tick softly into one.
So the fellow or the object of the desire was just as messed up as she was at that point.
As much in love or in heat as she. But then she has plenty of first person things written to her lover, whomever it was. Here's what she says about love. Love is anterior to life, posterior to death. Initial of creation and the exponent of breath.
Love me tender, love me sweet. Never let me go. You have made my life complete, and I love you so. Love me tender, love me true, all my dreams fulfill. For my darling, I love you, and I always will. Love me tender. Love me long, take me to your heart, for it's then that I belong, and will never part.
So how do we sum it up as we reach the end of this hour on romantic love, in anticipation of St. Valentine's Day? Named for a bishop who presumably was celibate and sent little cheery notes out the windows. Had nothing to do with the kind of thing we're talking about. Although I guess in medieval times, they did believe that February 14th was the day the birds chose their mates. So, any final thoughts on romantic love before we leave the topic? Richard Landis, medieval historian, and...
It's dangerous and therefore exciting. It's disruptive and therefore difficult to sustain over time. It's possibly resistible on an individual level, but in a culture it's going to appear over and over again. And the West has experimented with it and given it a place that I think very few other cultures ever have.
Bob Levine.
I hope I die before I have my final thoughts on love.
Man. Well, I still think it defies definition, but I would say romantic love, passionate love, is an altered state. It's temporary insanity. It's hormones and chemicals and glands and just a sort of invisible electrical charge between you and another person.
Well, on that note...
And everybody should experience it at least once.
At least.
Although both of you sound weary when you say that. On that note, I'll thank you all three for participating. You've been listening to a Boston University World of Ideas roundtable discussion on the history and effects of romantic love. Our guests have been Boston Globe writer, columnist, and occasional poet Bella English, professor of English Robert Levine of the College of Arts and Sciences, and historian and director of the Center of Millennial Studies, Professor Richard Landis.
You ask how much I need you. Must I explain? I need you, oh my darling, like roses need rain. You ask how long I'll love you. I'll tell you true, until the 12th of never, I'll still be loving you.
For a cassette of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. That's 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes are $15, including shipping and handling. This program was produced by Ben Walker and Bob Zalisk. I'm Ted O'Brien. Thanks for joining us.